This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Good afternoon, everybody. Very nice to see you all here today. My name's Jill Grimshaw. I'm part of the Cambridge Assessment Network, which is the organisation that organises this suite of seminars, lectures, conversations, discussions, whatever you'll call them. So it's very nice to see you here today. We have an all-star cast, three people lined up to talk to you today. We have Gwyn Lewis, who's over from Bangor. He's made a long journey to get to us today in Cambridge. That's Cambridge's fault, not Bangor's fault, as I was explaining. You know, it's the place we put it. I was talking to Stuart about the background to this interesting topic that we're looking into. As you probably know, Cambridge International Examinations deals with lots of students for whom English is a second or maybe third, or I don't know what number, language. So lots of the people that the examinations are taken by don't have English as their first language. And so I think this is one of the things that they're very interested in, is seeing how people who you might class as bilingual or trilingual or something, you know, how do they cope in studying and then in taking examinations. So what we're going to hear today is Gwyn telling us about the background in this idea of what's called translanguaging, which I've just discovered about, and then Stuart looking at the implications of that, looking at the literature, and then Helen telling us about how they're trying to operationalise it in the CIE context, where, as I said, you have a very multilingual group of people taking the examinations. I'm sure there'll be lots and lots to talk about, lots of stuff for them to say. So, I think, Gwyn, you're going to start us off, aren't you?
Yeah.
So, would you like to take the stand?
Thanks very much for the invitation and for the warm welcome here to Cambridge. This is my second visit, actually, to Cambridge. And I didn't think when I was coming today by train, I started from Bangor at 8 o'clock this morning, I had to go to London first and then travel up northwards to Cambridge. When I came by car last time, it was to Birmingham and then from west to east. Anyway, I'm here. Now, to me, coming from a bilingual Welsh background, translanguaging is as natural as breathing. I do it every day without thinking. This morning, for example, my wife and I read the daily newspaper in English over breakfast and discussed its contents with each other in Welsh. We watched an English television programme last night and then chatted about it in Welsh. That's a daily natural procedure for us as a family. It's a natural part of my daily life, both at home with my wife and the children and at work in Bangor University. And in the first part of this seminar this afternoon, the focus will be on bilingual pedagogic practice, specifically that of translanguaging. Now, historically, schools have kept boundaries between languages. But more recently, schools are experimenting, especially in Wales, with using two languages concurrently within the same lesson. And one of those prevalent bilingual pedagogical practices in bilingual education in the 21st century is that of translanguaging, which in essence switches the language mode of input and output in the same lesson, and which has been adopted as a key modern concept in bilingual classrooms and communities. Obviously, as you've heard, the practice of translanguaging has implications for assessment. I won't touch on that thorny issue, and you'll see why I call it thorny later on. Why I won't touch on that thorny issue, I leave that to the experts towards the end of this seminar. Now, translanguaging is a rather new and developing term. I don't know how many of you have heard the term before. Some of you came up to me at the beginning and said that you've never heard of the term until you looked it up for this seminar. Well, it was first used as a Welsh word, trawsiaethu. Now then, I'll give you a test at the end to see if you can pronounce the word trawsiaethu in the 1980s by a personal colleague and friend of mine, Dr. Ken Williams. Then it was popularised mainly by two books, Colin Baker's Foundations and Ophelia Garcia from New York, her Bible on bilingual education in the 21st century. Now, as a subtitle to my presentation, I've adopted the words of the chief executive of Gwynedd County Council in Northwest Wales, a local authority in Wales that was very pioneering in its Welsh language policy in the 1970s, especially in the field of education. And these are his words. We bring up our children to speak Welsh and become bilingual, not for the sake of language, although some people might advocate that it's a political thing in Wales, not for the sake of the language, but for the sake of the children, that it benefits the children to be bilingual. It is in this context, the context of this quotation, that in Wales of the 21st century, bilingual education, that is Welsh and English, has an increasingly high profile. And alongside other countries where bilingual education flourishes, Wales has a long and distinguished history of minority language education and also shares international leadership of bilingual policies and practices. As emphasised in the recently published Welsh Medium Education Strategy of the Welsh Government, which acknowledges the growth of Welsh medium education and also that many bilingual and multilingual communities across the world look towards Wales as an example of best practice. And it's a privilege, actually, to spend a week this summer with Ophelia Garcia, who came over especially from New York to look at the bilingual education system in Wales and specifically to look at translanguaging. And we had some very interesting exchange of ideas and views. Now, this growth in the number of non-Welsh-speaking pupils, that's significant in the Wales context. The number of non-Welsh-speaking pupils attending Welsh medium schools poses both an opportunity and a challenge. Classes in primary and secondary schools across Wales may well contain a wide linguistic variety. Native Welsh speakers, learners of Welsh, children from non-Welsh and children from non-English-speaking homes. Now, this gives rise to wide variations in teaching methodologies, especially the amount of Welsh and English being taught through and also in the allocation of languages across the curriculum. And there is growing experimentation in Wales at the moment in the concurrent and contemporaneous use of both languages within the same lesson period. And you can go from one school to the next and find different practices. I think Stewart will be quoting a saying by a colleague of mine, Colin Baker, about the kaleidoscopic variety of bilingual education in Wales. It's a small country, but you move from one school to the next, you move the kaleidoscope one little bit, and the pattern changes. Hence, the development of translanguaging. And that's a provisional and developing idea. Colin Baker defines translanguaging as the process of making meaning, shaping experiences, gaining understanding and knowledge through the use of two languages. Both languages used in an integrated and coherent way to organise and mediate mental processes in learning. Now, this growing popularity of the term relates to a change in the way bilingual and multilingual education has developed, not only among academics, but also amid changing politics and public understandings about bilingual education and multilingual education in the 21st century. And that's where I'd like to begin, the context in which trawsieithu, or translanguaging, has developed. And here I turn to Wales, because it is in the context of Wales that the first 1980s use of translanguaging was in education. This needs to be understood in terms of a reaction against the historic separation of two monolingualisms, Welsh and English, with a difference in prestige and status between both languages. Now, in education, separating languages in the classroom, either by subject or topic, by teacher or by time, has hitherto been fashionable. One example is the two-way immersion system in the United States, where languages, Spanish and English, are kept separate in theory by being used either on alternate days, alternate half days, or alternate lessons. Now, the tide internationally is slowly moving away from separating languages to the use of two or more languages within the same lesson. This reflects the idea that children pragmatically use both of their languages in order to maximise understanding and performance in the home, in the street, and the school. Thus, the use of languages in classrooms has begun to move towards more concurrent and integrated use of two or more languages for learning. This can be seen in Baker's comment, where he says that we seem to be witnessing a change from effective models to effective practices. And he says that the future for European bilingual education is to move away from the simplicity of the typologies that we have already been living with to engaging with optimal classroom dual language practices in order to maximise growth and gains for individual children. That sentiment is echoed by Ofelia Garcia, where she refers to bilingual education in the modern world includes forms where two or more languages are separated, but also forms where two or more languages are used together in complex combinations. Now, that's the historical context in which translanguaging is developing in education. Can I now turn to the origin of the term and how it has developed and is developing from the 1980s up to the present day? And I'll start with my colleague Ken Williams and the Welsh origins of translanguaging. The term translanguaging, trawsieithu, was created by Ken Williams in the 1980s. And he devised the word trawsieithu for the planned and systematic use of two languages for teaching and learning inside the same lesson. Planned and systematic. Now then, this is an email from Ken to Colin Baker to put the record straight about who coined the term. Ken is on the left, and a colleague of his was a director of education, the late David Whittell. This is Ken setting the record straight regarding the term trawsieithu. David Whittell and I and myself came up with the term during a course for deputy head teachers in a bar in Llandudno, the queen of the Welsh resorts. There might be the effect of alcohol on the term in the 1980s. I told you, Colin, and used the English translation as translinguifying originally. Then you, Colin, preferred translanguaging and it stuck. So that's to set the record straight. Now, it was initially coined to name a pedagogical practice which deliberately switches the language mode of input and output. This is Ken's interpretation. You receive information through the medium of one language and use it yourself through the medium of the other language. Before you can use that information successfully, you must have fully understood it. And that's the thrust behind translanguaging, in that it deepens understanding of certain concepts in bilingual situations. And the term has remained an important feature of Welsh medium education and has also been adopted in other parts of the world as a key modern concept in bilingual classrooms and communities. Capturing the imagination of those who believe that teachers, and particularly students and pupils, naturally use both languages to maximise learning. Now, the term trawsieithu was invented, yes, by Ken Williams, but it is linked to Rodolfo Jacobson's concept of purposeful concurrent uses of two languages in a bilingual classroom, and to Christian Foltis's discussion of 16 cues for switching the language medium of teaching. However, Ken Williams emphasized that translanguaging refers to different uses of two languages from that outlined by Jacobson and Foltis. Translanguaging, according to Ken Williams, entails using one language to reinforce the other in order to increase understanding and in order to augment the pupil's ability in both languages. I'll illustrate these points further later on. Ken Williams goes on to describe the process of translanguaging from the child's perspective. Pupils internalize new ideas they hear. They assign their own understanding to the concept and simultaneously and immediately utilize the concept in the other language. And in doing so, they augment and supplement the concept through dual language processing. Ken Williams suggested that the process of translanguaging uses various cognitive processing skills in listening and reading, the receptive skills, then the assimilation and accommodation of the information retrieved by listening and reading, and then by choosing and selecting from the brain storage to communicate in either speaking or writing, the productive skills. Thus, translanguaging requires a deeper understanding than just translating. It's more than just translating from one language to the other. It moves from finding parallels to processing and relaying meaning and understanding. Translanguaging therefore commenced as a pedagogical theory with an emphasis on the child and not the teacher. And Ken Williams suggests that translanguaging focuses more on the pupil's use of two languages and what they are able to achieve by using both languages rather than on the teacher's role, although teachers may engineer translanguaging within the class. Ken Williams also advocated that translanguaging is more appropriate for children who have a reasonably good grasp of both languages and may not be a valuable tool in a classroom when children are in the early stages of learning and developing the second language. Now, this leads me to the proposed advantages of translanguaging. Ken Williams' publications and conference presentations became well known in Wales with dissemination in Welsh and in English. But in 2001, Colin Baker publicised translanguaging through the third edition of his book, Foundations, and this launched the term internationally. And this is Colin's definition. It describes the hearing or reading of a lesson, a passage in a book or a section of work in one language, and the development of the work in the other language. Translanguaging is a more specific term than the general umbrella term concurrent use of two languages. In translanguaging, the input, reading or hearing, tends to be in one language and the output, speaking or writing, in the other language. And Colin Baker went on to discuss four potential advantages to translanguaging, and therefore arguing for the importance of the concept as a pedagogical practice. First of all, that it may promote a deeper and fuller understanding of the subject matter. It may help students understand and gain a deeper understanding of the subject matter. Taking the idea of the Vygotskian zone of proximal development, that further learning is based on stretching pre-existing knowledge, Baker argued that translanguaging is an effective and efficient way of enabling this. And he argues that it is possible in a monolingual teaching situation for students to answer questions, write an essay, without fully understanding it. They might copy whole sentences or paragraphs, or from dictation or from the internet, without real understanding. It is less easy to do so with translanguaging. To read and discuss a topic in one language and then to write about it in another language means that the subject matter has to be processed and digested. And Baker argues that this fits into a socio-cultural theory of learning, where the teacher can allow a student to use both languages in a planned, developmental and strategic manner to maximise cognitive capability and to deepen the knowledge and understanding of the content. The second potential advantage is that it may help students to develop competence in the weaker language. And that's very true in Welsh medium education, because so many children come from non-Welsh speaking homes. Translanguaging tends to happen from English into Welsh, so that they develop their productive skills in the Welsh language. Thirdly, it may facilitate homeschool links and cooperation, especially if the child is being educated in a language that is not understood by the parents. Translanguaging involves the reprocessing of content. It may lead to deeper understanding and learning, and this in turn allows the child to expand, extend, and intensify what he has learned through one language in school, through discussion with the parent at home in the other language. And fourthly, it may help the integration of fluent Welsh speakers and Welsh learners of various levels of fluency. Second language ability, subject content learning can be developed concurrently if a sensitive and strategic use is made of both languages in class. This advantage was particularly important in Ken Williams's original discussion of translanguaging, in that he argued that it develops a student's minority language, be it their first or second language. Now, the term translanguaging was promoted in education in Wales at the turn of the 21st century, not just by academics, but through central government and official channels, giving it acceptance and promotion. Estyn, Her Majesty's Inspectorate for Education, in a discussion paper on developing dual literacy, argued that the skills involved in dual literacy are sometimes called translanguaging or transliterative skills, and they go on to outline the importance of developing dual literacy from those three perspectives there. Developing intellectual development, preparing individuals to learn additional languages, and also preparing individuals for situations where they need to use both languages and transfer from one language to the other. And Estyn, they emphasise that dual literacy and translanguaging is important because it assists individuals' intellectual development by refining their ability to think, understand, and internalise information in two languages. And that this process can help to reinforce learning. What began in Wales in the early 1980s has developed and very recently caught the imagination of expert North American and English educationalists. I've mentioned Ophelia Garcia, who thinks that translanguaging is a powerful mechanism to construct understandings, to include others, and to mediate understandings across language groups. She also sees translanguaging in a different light to code switching, in that it refers to the process by which bilingual students perform bilingually in the myriad ways of classrooms: reading, writing, taking notes, discussing, signing, etc. It is a way of making sense of learning and language. Garcia also suggests that translanguaging is increasingly and serendipitously prevalent in many bilingual classrooms. Despite those arrangements that separate languages, the most prevalent bilingual practice in the bilingual education classrooms is that of translanguaging, she says. And she argues that linguistically integrated group work is prevalent in many bilingual classrooms. In Welsh contexts, there is flexibility. You notice the word that children themselves use, their entire linguistic repertoire, flexibly there. This flexibility in Welsh context is becoming evident. Pupils can read a worksheet that contains both Welsh and English texts and then go on to write in Welsh and or in English, using information retrieved from both the Welsh and English texts. Especially in history, where you access authentic texts in English. Rather than translating them to Welsh, just for the purpose of the lesson, you access the authentic, original text in English, and then, because it's Welsh medium education, you discuss what you've already read in Welsh. Another eminent United States educationalist who has recently joined Ophelia Garcia in both substantiating and extending the meaning of translanguaging is Nancy Hornberger. I'll just mention the word. I will not expand on her thoughts and ideas this afternoon because time is going on. And also Crees and Blackledge. I understand that Aidan Blackledge was here in Cambridge earlier this week. And Crees and Blackledge argue for a release from monolingual instructional approaches so that two or more languages are used alongside each other. Now, a little bit about the research that we've been doing in Wales into translanguaging. A five-year research project, we've observed over 100 lessons in primary and secondary schools across Wales, and we observed that translanguaging was present in approximately a third of all lessons as the only or dominant approach. And we have observed two models. Purposive, constructed and planned translanguaging, which is teacher-controlled, or serendipitous, unconstructed, unplanned activity, which is pupil-controlled and pupil-chosen. Now, can I just whisk through some examples with you? This first example comes from a work in history by a group of 9 and 10-year-old pupils in a small rural primary school through the medium of Welsh. A group of 6 pupils, some from Welsh-speaking homes, from some English-speaking homes, were discussing the eating habits of Stone Age people. They accessed information in English from the internet on the left. They discussed the information in Welsh, and then they recorded their findings in writing in Welsh. I was there observing the lesson, and those children used Welsh terminology for different animal organs, iau for liver, arennau for kidneys, spontaneously without the aid of a dictionary. And the oral presentation to the rest of the group on their findings was in Welsh, since that was the medium of the lesson. We are also experimenting with developing our terminology. Now, this slide is what we call emergent translanguaging, in that it shows an English worksheet with the majority of the children in that classroom coming from non-Welsh speaking homes. It is a religious education lesson on Hanukkah. The pupils were asked to read the information on the English worksheet and then to write 5 statements in Welsh based on the contents of the worksheet. It's a Welsh medium school. The majority of the children come from English-speaking homes. The teacher scaffolded the task of translanguaging with the pupils. She supported them with the reading in English and with the writing in Welsh. She co-read the English text with them and gave them models of sentence patterns in Welsh for the written task. And you can see there the word mae. That's a specific sentence structure that she drilled to them. Another feature of teacher-controlled translanguaging is that of giving pupils specific and structured cues. This is an example of a PowerPoint slide that was in Welsh. I translated it for this afternoon by a geography teacher to a group of Year 12 sixth form pupils. They were studying patterns of migration as identified by experts like Zielinski, Ravenstein and Lee. The pupils were given those cues, a structure on how to work. Reading in English, discussing ways of explaining the theories in Welsh, designing a PowerPoint presentation in Welsh, and giving the presentation and handouts in Welsh based on the English texts. Those were carried out in Welsh medium schools, using authentic English materials, but the medium of the lesson was Welsh. Now then, pupils themselves also acknowledge and recognise the advantages of translanguaging. I can refer specifically to two 15-year-old pupils interviewed during a secondary school GCSE science lesson on the Human Genome Project. They were asked to gather information from an English website. They were asked to create a poster presentation to the rest of the class in either Welsh or English. And two pupils, one from a Welsh-speaking home and one from an English-speaking home, specifically decided to create the poster and give the presentation in Welsh. I asked them why they chose this line of action. And their answer was, we deliberately did this, that is, translanguaging from Welsh to English, so as to avoid copying the original material from the internet word for word in English in order for us to fully understand the information conveyed in the English text. And they said that they could easily give the presentation without having to read their notes because they had processed the information and they could give an oral presentation rather than reading their notes. Some other responses from children that we gathered during the research about translanguaging. These are pupils' words. It's so natural. It's difficult to start with, but you improve quite quickly. These presentations give us confidence for when we go to university. It helps that we simplify the work. We have to think about it. You come to understand the work better and you learn independently. We understand it better, and then if we want a definition of translanguaging from pupils themselves, translanguaging is translating to make sense. And that coincides with Ofelia Garcia's definition of sense-making. That's what she calls translanguaging. Now then, I conclude, and just two or three minutes, just to make the link to your presentations on assessment. To conclude, Garcia sees that the way forward for bilingual education is not to separate languages, as we have done in the past, but to develop bilingual and multilingual discourse practices. Translanguaging, she says, is indeed the only way to build the plurilingual abilities that we will need in the future. And so, to bilingual assessment. Again, Ofelia Garcia says that no area of bilingual education is in more need of development than that of bilingual assessment, in order to reflect what's happening in classrooms. That's her argument. And she says that the issue of assessment, as I said earlier, is perhaps the most thorny issue in bilingual education contexts. Can I finish just by mentioning some of the features of bilingual assessment in Wales? The WJEC, the Welsh Joint Education Committee, provides examination papers in both English and Welsh in all subjects. And those children entered for Welsh medium examinations by the WJEC are permitted to use both versions of the papers side by side during the examination in accordance with the school's policy and the way that they have been taught. Another developmental aspect of the Welsh examination system that accommodates bilingual students in a way that reflects their bilingual teaching and learning is to allow bilingual students to answer questions in either language on the examination paper. And this is in line with the sentiments expressed by Ophelia Garcia that flexible assessments should be used with bilingual students so they are given the opportunity to show their proficiency in both languages and demonstrate their academic achievement in content areas in any of their two languages. And so, to the most thorny issue in bilingual education context, I pass over to Stuart and then to Helen.
Well, I want to thank Gwyn for his eloquent and excellent summary of translanguaging as a pedagogic practice. But our concern, of course, is with assessment and the pragmatic and potentially gargantuan issues that translanguaging presents a busy international awarding body. As you know, communication in the 21st century includes very complex discursive practices, including a range of different modalities, multimodalities, visual, audio, spatial semiotic systems, which also includes written linguistic modes of meaning and their integration in a linguistic fashion. And this presents a number of challenges for Cambridge International Examinations. And so I'm going to be looking at the implications of translanguaging within assessment. It is always worthwhile revisiting an important and an influential quotation. We've just seen it from Garcia. She issued this clarion call as a warning to the bilingual educational community in general, but also to assessment specialists in particular. No area of bilingual education is in more need of development than that of bilingual assessment. She also went on to say that there is an urgent need to develop assessment that can tap the plural literacies of multimodal texts, which bilingual children must produce in the 21st century. The monolingualism of most assessments does not reflect bilingual practice in the 21st century classroom. And so it's to this that we need to look in order to inform future development of bilingual assessments. And thus far, there have been a number of shortcomings in the kinds of instruments we use to assess bilingual students, more particularly psychometric shortcomings, which we'll look at very shortly. But surely the most important thing about bilingual assessment is that we must determine the totality of language proficiency and competence and confidence of our bilingual or emergent bilingual learners. I want to begin by looking at the Cambridge Research Programme very quickly. Cambridge International Examinations has been very keen to evaluate the impact of the choice of bilingual education, and more particularly, the role of assessment within that choice. And what we have done over the last 3 or 4 years is to construct a research programme which is grounded in principles relating to themes. These themes are bilingualism and learning, assessment, pedagogy, and curriculum. And we have organised or structured our research agenda against 4 overarching themes that we can think of as questions. What is the impact, for example, of different teaching environments? And within each of these themes, there is a raft of subordinate secondary issues to consider. So, for example, what is the impact of the choice of subject taught in a second language? A second theme relates to bilingual education on the teaching and the learning process. One particular question that interests me at the moment is how academic skills and subject knowledge skills transfer across languages. Jin Cummins, a leading luminary in the area of bilingual education, has suggested that according to the sociolinguistic situation, there are five types of cross-linguistic transfer. These relate to transfer of conceptual elements, transfer of metacognitive and metalinguistic strategies, transfer of pragmatic aspects of use, transfer of specific linguistic elements, and transfer of phonological awareness. Another key question relates to the notion of bilingual education and its impact on students as they prepare for tertiary level study. At an international level, there is a dearth of very basic research at how bilingually educated students are both prepared for and ready for the rigours of tertiary level schooling. And of course, the main and key concern from my perspective relates to assessment issues. One of those assessment issues, for example, relates to adaptations, accommodations, and modifications to tests. Having constructed our research agenda, it was then very necessary to review some of the literature, but to review that literature in a judicious and pertinent way, in ways that would help and inform the Cambridge programme. Our first commission was for Gwyn, and in fact he presented us with, according to a list of structured questions that were relevant to our own context, an overview of bilingual education. We were particularly interested in the section relating to assessment methods and adaptations. Having reviewed this particular research, we then focused on translanguaging, and I have to confess that I'm not an expert in bilingual education, but translanguaging just immediately sprang out of the text as being exciting and complex and interesting and possibly relevant in terms of formative assessment and school-based assessments. This gave birth to a second review, more particularly focusing on translanguaging. And what we wanted to do here was to recruit three PhD students under the tutelage and superintendence of Garcia at the Graduate Centre of the City University of New York and ask them to undertake a review of the literature relating to translanguaging within assessment from three disparate perspectives: assessment of bilinguals, assessment for bilinguals, and new ways of designing bilingual assessments. This particular report was structured around four principal questions. What is an appropriate model, for example, for assessing bilinguals? What should this model look like in terms of its appearance? The underlying constructs that we want to test? How should it be delivered in terms of accommodations, in terms of administration and implementation? And how should it be developed in terms of design and piloting? From these two external reviews of the literature and the reviews that we undertook internally within Cambridge, we decided that there were three principal messages that we wanted to pursue relating to complexity, to challenge, and also to change. Bilingual education is indeed very complex. In 1970, for example, McKay suggested that actually there were something like 90 different variables associated with bilingual education. In 1998, Baker and Jones constructed a taxonomy of 9 different models of education, weak and strong models of education bilingually. All of which leads, of course, to that famous quote, kaleidoscopic variety of bilingual education practice. But of course, it's also very challenging. It's challenging for both teachers and students. Teachers, for example, who are teaching in these contexts have to be able to make their materials accessible to students for whom English is not a first language. And the students have to recover meaning from the text, understand it, and use it, and demonstrate their content mastery. It is quite clear that the traditional typologies and the variety of those typologies over the last 40 years are in considerable need of expansion in order to be able to capture the linguistic complexity of the 21st century emergent bilingual and multilingual learner. we have seen effectively a shift from models to practices, a discernible shift away from strict separation of languages to the notion of multilingual discursive practice. And Garcia, in a very large, commanding, and comprehensive review of the literature relating to assessments and how they can be undertaken in the context of bilingualism, suggested that translanguaging ought to be incorporated more pragmatically in assessment. So that relates to the background of Cambridge. And what I want to do now is to talk about some assessment issues. The voluminous literature is replete with very technical and complex theories, and also a range of different examples. And within 20, 25 minutes, it's very difficult to present this material. But I want to give you a flavour and perhaps engender within you a raft of different questions and issues for consideration. The knowledge that students bring to the classroom, their expertise, their background schemata, their experiences, all are designed to demonstrate a content mastery. But unfortunately, assessments within schools do not necessarily ask bilinguals to demonstrate that content mastery because they assume them to be monolinguals and, in a sense, are expected to throw off their bilingualism. This is because most current assessments of bilingual students have developed from what is a monoglossic perspective. And axiomatic to the monoglossic paradigm is an assumption underlying this perspective, the notion that, in fact, there's no difference in the language development of monolinguals and bilinguals. So, from the monoglossic perspective, students are treated as, monolinguals rather, are treated as norm. Languages are treated as separable entities in the minds of multilingual people. From this perspective, the bilingual student is understood to be two monolinguals and with access to two separate language systems, which in a sense develop in a linear fashion and are assessed quite distinctly and quite separately. But even from an intuitive perspective, this seems fundamentally flawed. And in fact, the research corroborates this and suggests that bilinguals have different patterns of development than monolinguals of either language. And Baker more recently has suggested that bilinguals are not a simple sum of two monolinguals, but are a unique combination and integration of language. Current educational language policy is beginning to challenge the notion of the monoglossic perspective and has given rise to more dynamic conceptualizations of bilingualism. Bilingualism now can be conceptualized or thought of in very dynamic ways. Garcia, who has introduced the notion of dynamic bilingualism, is demonstrative of this shift in thinking. And she suggests that dynamic bilingualism, in fact, embraces hybrid language practices of multilingual language communities. And it's this notion of hybrid, of integration, that is key to the assessment link. So instead of using idealized notions of language, both in the classroom and in assessments, there is this integrated and hybrid component. Dynamic bilingualism and the assessments of dynamic bilingualism has its roots in the work of the 1960s, particularly with dynamic assessments. And this, of course, has its genesis in the pioneering work, the sociocultural theory of Vygotsky, which I think Gwyn talked about earlier. The point about dynamic bilingual assessments is that it allows or permits emergent bilingual students, those who are not yet fully bilingual, and that in itself is a problematic statement, to utilise their entire linguistic repertoire, their suite of language skills. So in contrast to a monoglossic perspective, the heteroglossic perspective sees languages as not as separable necessarily, but as interacting in a hybrid and a complex way, certainly in both the minds and in the outworkings of those minds of multilinguals. And this reconceptualization leads to the notion of hybrid processes, which allows translanguaging to be manifest. So what are those implications for translanguaging? Most schools tend to emphasize the assessment of academic language proficiency. And unfortunately, this gives rise to what I believe is inequitable assessment practice for emergent bilinguals and multilinguals. They tend very quickly to focus on the comprehension and use of specialized vocabulary, linguistic complexity, register, formality, cohesive devices, and demonstration and understanding of sound systems, phonology, and syntactical and semantic structures. How do we address this inequality, this iniquity in assessment practice? Well, translanguaging perhaps suggests the way forward. A fairer assessment framework would integrate both dimensions of language proficiency and content proficiency, rather than the conflational combination of the two. So what we're seeing here is content and language integration. And of course, this has given rise to a proliferation of CLIL programs, both within Europe and now increasingly beyond. I'm conscious of time, so I may skip through some of the overheads rather quickly. Quite independently, Baker and Garcia have emphasized strategic use of language in classrooms and in assessments. In other words, if the task at hand for a student is to learn a specific function of language, then this needs to be taken into consideration very seriously when developing an appropriate, valid, reliable assessment that is more focused on a particular language use. However, if the goal of a class or a lesson or a unit is that of content knowledge or development, or perhaps critical thinking, or development of some academic skill, then translanguaging may be used both strategically and judiciously in allowing students to engage in a range of linguistic skills, a suite of repertoires, in order to represent both their understanding and also their learning. I'm going to skip over this quite quickly because I think Gwyn has talked about a number of examples in the classroom. But the notion that is central to bilingual dynamic assessment relates to the flexible use of language. And Garcia, in quite a monumental study of New York City high schools in 2010, looked at a whole range of different practices where the teachers in content area classrooms were more interested in demonstrating or assessing the demonstration of content ability rather than mastery of language. So we've seen a number of examples where two languages can be used and juxtaposed. One interesting classroom that she recounts relates to semantic maps and the construction of a map with linguistic labels using both English and Spanish. So, for example, the topic headings were in English, the Spanish in topic details were in Spanish, rather. In another class, a ninth grade humanities class, students were given the same story written on various English levels, and then after this were given various opportunities to discuss their understanding, their comprehension of this particular story, but discussing it in the language of their choice. And likewise, we see in a history lesson the choice of language given to students and the choice given to write or produce a presentation based on that. I want now to turn to the notion of accommodations within a monoglossic paradigm. So we have these two contrasting perspectives. The monoglossic paradigm, which seems to dominate the assessment of bilinguals, and we have the heteroglossic, which we're going to come to very shortly. I think it's true to say that dynamic assessment from its socio-cultural beginnings and grounding has received considerable amount of attention in the literature. However, in reality, bilingual students, emergent bilingual students, are increasingly more marginalized in terms of assessment practice. whereby dynamic bilingualism is used, it's quite often used highly theoretically or in a non-systematic way. And what this has meant is that there are no suitable, valid, or reliable instruments from the monoglossic perspective to assess bilingual students. So what happens, or what has tended to happen until fairly recently, is that the students are expected to perform comparably to their English proficient counterparts on tests that are normed on monolingual populations. Though, of course, they are permitted to use modifications or accommodations. And it's to the nature of accommodations within the monoglossic paradigm that I just want to spend a little bit of time. According to the standards of psychological and educational testing, an accommodation is a change made in the content, format, or administration procedure of a test in order to accommodate test takers who are unable to take the original test under standard test conditions. This gives rise to a number of assessment issues, four of which are particularly relevant to the development of tests for bilinguals. The notion of effectiveness. What strategies, for example, minimise language proficiency effects and enable English language learners to demonstrate that content area knowledge? The key question for me is one of validity. Does the provision of an accommodation help English learners by reducing the language barrier and thereby narrowing the performance, the distinction between English proficient and non-proficient students? Or conversely, does it affect the content? More alarmingly, possibly affecting the underlying constructs that we intend to measure. What about the notion of differential demographic variables? For example, students with background variables such as ethnicity, gender, and socioeconomic status. How do these impact upon the accommodations used? Do girls perform better with certain types of accommodation than boys? And of course, even if we can satisfy all three criteria, we still have the notion of feasibility. And in the context of a very busy awarding body, this is particularly important. Accommodations need to be both practical and affordable. There are, broadly speaking, two types of accommodations: a modification to a test or a modification to a test procedure. And I'm going to focus on modification of test in two areas: test translation and linguistic simplification. According to Butler and Stevens, there is very little empirical basis for the use of accommodations, though the literature and practice is replete with accommodations being used and implemented in various cases. Why? Because there's a lack of systematicity in how they are implemented, and most times the accommodations do not tailor to meet the specific needs of individuals. I'm conscious again of time, so I'm going to move quite quickly. Translation has received a great deal of attention in the literature, but there is a general consensus within that literature that this is by no means a straightforward process. There are two grave problems. One relates to the maintenance of the integrity of the construct in two psychometrically supposedly equivalent or comparable tests, and the other relates to the notion of vocabulary equivalence. What about the solutions to this? Well, there are two very broad responses in the literature. Solano, Flores and Trumbull, apologies for the pronunciation, have suggested concurrent translation. This is robust and effective, but perhaps impractical in the context in which we operate, creating assessments in both languages simultaneously. But Garcia and her colleagues have gone one stage further by recommending a process that they call transadaptation. In this situation, assessments are created in the home language from the beginning, and then they're normed on bilingual populations that they're going to be used on. And this obviates the need for certain validity considerations, issues relating to translation for English, and issues relating to the comparison with bilingual populations and monolingual populations. Simplification has received the most attention in the literature and has the most empirical support. Why? because it's both effective, the first criterion we looked at, and it's also valid. Why? Because it doesn't affect the performance of English proficient students. It's to the area of validity that I now want to focus. And I have a number of issues, because validity is my topic, really, and I have a number of issues that I'm very happy to discuss today and beyond this seminar with a number of people. According to the literature, and this is an overriding consensus, an accommodation is valid only if it increases scores of emergent bilinguals without increasing scores of their English proficient peers. To an extent, I'm comfortable with that notion. Less comfortable, however, with the alternative. Scores of emergent bilinguals increase at a higher rate than their English proficient peers. I think there are difficulties there. However, if both groups experience similar growth, or in fact there is no growth, then the accommodation used may not be addressing differences in language proficiency, and surely this is the overriding purpose for the introduction of the accommodation. Now, I'm going to finish very shortly, but I want to look, before we look at translanguaging in the heteroglossic perspective, at two examples given in the literature which constitute challenges to emergent bilinguals and which we find in the monoglossic corpus of assessment. Solano Flores, sorry about pronunciation, and Trumbull have undertaken a considerable amount of work looking at test items, and more particularly, what kinds of items constitute different problems for different language groups, second language groups. Their work is solidly grounded in text and discourse analysis, empirical properties, but more importantly, from our perspective, there is a focus on socio-cultural differentials. This is an example from the NAEP, and I'm going to ask you to read it, and then I'm going to ask you to tell me, if you would, why this presented such a problem for many hundreds of students who were categorised as emergent bilinguals, particularly the lower socio-economic status students. Any ideas? Have a read. Okay, anyone like to proffer a reason why this presented such enormous problems for so many students? Oh, sorry. Sorry? The word bill. It wasn't the word bill. It was the word only. And I have a problem now. It's not moving for me. I'm not getting any movement at all. Okay. Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to conclude.
Oh no!
Thank you. So the main issue here was one of only. Students had no problems understanding the content, no difficulties understanding the mathematical operators and applications and manipulations, but they were thwarted by the use of the word only, because the assumption here is that only $1 was made available for the purchasing of these items, which clearly went beyond that amount. This is a kind of disparity that can be eliminated almost immediately in the context of monoglossic assessments. It's not working. What did you do?
You have to blow on it.
Huh?
You have to blow on it.
Okay, thank you.
Is that it?
Okay. Sorry, we've got a technical problem here. I want to give you yet another example of challenges to emergent bilinguals. And this is based in the work undertaken by Martinello. Martinello has been responsible for a number of verbal protocol analyses with students, particularly in the context of mathematics. Students who are as able as their English proficient counterparts in terms of mathematical aptitude and ability, but don't have their mastery of the language. Here is the question. I'll read it to you. It's not abundantly clear. To win a game, Tamika must spin an even number on a spinner identical to the one shown below. Are Tamika's chances of spinning an even number certain, likely, unlikely, or impossible? Now, I'm not asking you to answer this from a mathematical perspective, but what really presented huge problems for a great many emergent bilinguals when they encountered this particular question?
The word certain?
No. If you look at the first part of the question, to win a game, Tamika must spin an even number on a spinner identical to the one shown below. The students understood the one as the number one, whereas the one is an anaphoric reference, a pronoun referring to the spinner. So this clearly was a problem for the student. And interestingly enough, in follow-up retrospective analyses through semi-structured interviews and focused discussion groups, the students clearly understood the difference between even and odd numbers. I am going to finish very quickly. I just want to introduce you to the notion of conceptual scoring. And this is where we use translanguaging within a heteroglossic perspective. Not just in the question comprehension, because that's what we've been looking at in terms of accommodations, but also in a demonstration of their mastery of content knowledge. For example, conceptual scoring is being used increasingly more as a viable mode of scoring compared to monolingual. One illustration is given here. Children were asked to describe a ball. It's red and blue and has a stripe and a star. And I have it on very good authority that the Spanish here is absolutely correct. But notice we have a response, and this is within the context of an assessment, not within the classroom, where we have both English and Spanish as part of the written answer. In terms of monolingual scoring, this student would have received a 2 in either of those two languages. But in terms of conceptual scoring, because both concepts have been uniquely described in each language and articulated correctly, a conceptual score of 4 is given. Because this allows an overall estimate of the semantic total development of a child's language competence. So this moves me on to the final slides towards a universal test. The notion of accommodations is problematic. There is little consensus in the literature on how they should be used and when they should be used and in what contexts. So scholars are now being asked to reconceptualise and think out of the box and think about assessment as moving away from accommodating linguistically different students towards the notion of a universal design of test. The characteristic, the defining feature of a universal test design, which I think has real merit, is the notion that no accommodations are employed at all. And this coheres very nicely with the distinguishing features of dynamic bilingual assessments. It is possible through implementation of the principles of universal test design that the need for accommodations will in fact decrease. And the measurement of what students know, those critical underpinning constructs, and what they can perform in an assessment context will improve not just for some, but in fact for all students. How is this manifest in the literature? And you're going to have problems with this, Helen. One way in which it's manifest in the literature is through computerized adaptations of mathematical tests. We've skipped a slide, it won't let me go back. And where a pop-up glossary is provided for all students, so that all students receive the same accommodation And therefore, there is no accommodation introduced at all, which I think has particular potential and merit. I'm going to pass you over to Helen now, and I think that I'd like to leave you with a thought in terms of translanguaging practice within the context of international assessments and high-stakes, high-entry international assessments. Quite clearly, where there are localities such as Wales, which is quite small in population, and two languages are employed, then this has real potential for translanguaging in terms of assessment, and in certain parts of America where English and Spanish is used. But it has monumental issues for us when we're talking about high entry students. But I think a closer scrutiny and more clear reading of the literature suggests that classroom practice and formative assessment is where CIE should concentrate its efforts. So I'm now going to pass you over to Helen, who's going to look in more detail about the physical outworking of translanguaging through our work.
I'm just going to wrap this up and quickly zoom through and really talk about what can we, by we I mean Cambridge International Examinations, a typical international awarding body, what do we do with this information? Three sections here. I'm going to zoom through one and two and really focus on number three. Why is CIE interested in bilingualism? How are we supporting bilingual learners? And where could Trausyethi be relevant? I don't mean where in the world, but in what aspect of our work could it be relevant? why are we interested in bilingualism? Well, Gwyn mentioned that Professor Adrian Blackledge gave a seminar at the Faculty of Education on Monday. It's quite interesting. He was replacing the word bilingualism with lots of other terms: multilingualism, polylingualism, plurilingualism, heterolingualism. But just sticking with this term for the moment, students speaking two or more languages. Whereas bilingual education, and we do distinguish between bilingualism and bilingual education, and what is our bilingual strategy? So where is bilingualism? 40 governments, 160 countries, 9,000 schools. That's where we operate. The fact that our students are overseas, largely, learning through English as an additional language means that they have a first language. So to some extent, they are bilingual. And so we need to recognise that. So in that sense, we think that every learner is a language learner. Now, in terms of bilingual education, I don't want to get into a definition of what is bilingual education, but just for the sake of argument, let's say it's where some subjects are taught through one language, some subjects are taught through another language in the traditional sense, never mind the new multilingual within the classroom sense. Well, CIE schools are integrating English medium qualifications with a first language medium national curriculum. Not in all schools, but some schools are doing this, maybe in the Netherlands, Spain, Italy, South America, some countries in the Middle East. And then, of course, we have national partnerships, and our sibling organisation, Cambridge ESOL, is also involved with some of these projects, such as Egypt, Mongolia and Kazakhstan, where perhaps we've got more of the Wales context, possibly of dual or trilingual contexts. Now, what is our bilingual strategy? Well, we think that our learners, our bilingual learners all over the world, face certain challenges. Because English is a lingua mondo, lingua franca, and is the medium of instruction and examination for CIE qualifications. And let's not forget that we are an English medium exam board. That does place challenges on our students' access to English as a second language. It might place certain pressures on their own first language identity and culture, and it might place pressures on their motivation to be multilingual, be they overseas or in the UK. So we're beginning, these aren't official, but we're beginning to develop some principles that we value multilingualism, that every school, whether they are an English medium international school or a bilingual education school, can support the first and the second language. Every teacher is a language teacher. If you're a science or history teacher, you have a responsibility for scaffolding language. And every learner is a language learner, even in a science or maths class. These are actual goals from our business plan. So where there is official bilingual education, we want to develop approaches to bilingual education. And even in English medium international schools, we want to seek best practice to support teachers and students for whom English is an additional language. So yes, we're an exam board, but I work in an education division. The fact that we have an education division, we are looking beyond exams. Now, Stuart mentioned that the research uncovered three messages, that bilingual education is complex, challenging and changing. So how are we support? What are we doing about this? How are we supporting bilingual learners? Well, we've recently published with Cambridge University Press a book, Excellence in Bilingual Education, A Guide for School Principals by Peter Mahisto. And we do have an accompanying educational video, which we're in the process of editing, which was filmed in the Botanic Gardens. And I don't have time to show you the video clips now, but eventually they will be up on our website. But two of the video modules do talk about translanguaging. And I'd like to thank Gwyn, actually, because Gwyn came to our bilingual education symposium 18 months ago, and he injected that symposium with the idea of translanguaging, and it has actually fed into the book. And it's also the book, and it's also fed into the video. So the chapter on students, there's something about identity texts, because Jim Cummins has written the afterword and he focuses on bilingual identity texts, and so there's a little bit on that. The chapter on parents, Gwyn was talking about home-school cooperation, some tips there about how parents can use translanguaging as a technique. So the child comes home with homework, has to explain to their parent in their first language what to do, then has to translanguage back into the second language. The challenging question, we did some research and tried to identify the language minimum language levels of our IGCSE content subjects according to the CEFR, the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages, and tried to identify some of the language skills, generic academic language skills needed across subjects. And that led to another Cambridge University Press publication, Language Awareness and Teaching, and also an online course. But I'm going to just move on very quickly to, there's an example from the book where how science, maths, history teachers can plan language support into their lessons. And also Stuart assisted with a linguistic foundation, which is also in the book. So content teachers have a framework, an awareness of different kinds of language for describing, interpreting, creating, self-reflection. It also led to work with our assessment services division. Do we have anyone here from assessment services? Yes, we do. Language guidance for question writers. Here's an example. Avoid phrasal verbs. They use simple words, but, for example, put up with. A lot of our candidates, they'll know the meaning of the word put, they'll know the meaning of the word up, and they'll know the meaning of the word with, but put up with has a different sense. So we're trying to address this issue that Stuart mentioned of the language barrier. Coming to the third message, the fact that bilingual education is changing and translanguaging is entering the parlance. So is it just a fancy word for code switching, or as Adrian Blackledge called it, code meshing, I think he called it. Is it just a fancy phrase for mixing languages because you can't use either properly? Or is it, according to Garcia, the 21st century way forward for bilingual assessment? Would this mean exam questions in one language and responses in another language? Is this vision a pragmatic nightmare for us, or an educational opportunity? And where could it be relevant? At school level, classroom level, home assessments, school-based or external assessments? Is it relevant to dual language contexts like Wales and, I assume, Spanish, English and parts of the United States? Or is it relevant to our multilingual contexts? I visited a school in South Asia. It was an English medium school, and it had this sign saying English only, even though the children were dying to speak in their first language, because they said that to maximise achievement in English medium exams, they had to have maximum use of English. So what would translanguaging mean for the school language policy? What about for classroom use? So the book, Excellence in Bilingual Education, does talk about the need to agree language use in the classroom from the teacher, student, group work. Gwyn was talking about researching, perhaps in one language, reporting in another language, right through to where you have multilingual contexts, where you've got students with multiple first languages and you're supporting them using their first language to learn a second and a third language. The right-hand column is just my way of understanding the different ways of translanguaging. And I think at the top, in its very simplest form, it's a technique in the classroom to understand content taught through a second language. So you're using your first language as a tool to understand basically a monoglossic assessment. Right down to the bottom, where we're actually grappling with this, aren't we, Belinda, in Kazakhstan, with how to develop academic ability in the first and second and third language. So perhaps in a science classroom, it's not just to understand science taught through English, but also developing the academic language ability in, say, Kazakh and Russian. Quite challenging. Just got some quotes here again from the book. This is from Jim Cummins. He wrote the afterword. And my imagination has been particularly fired by his suggestion of inspirational pedagogy and bilingual identity texts. Now, the video clip actually talks about this. And if you do get a chance, have a look at the chapter on students. And there's an interview with Peter Mahister about what Jim Cummins says about bilingual identity texts. Again, we see our role as supporting schools to support parents and how they can use translanguaging as a tool to help deepen a student's understanding of the topic at home. And also, the parents can support the child in developing learning strategies so that they're not doing the homework for them. They have to do it in the second language once they've talked about it in the first language. What about assessment, the thorny issue of assessment? Stuart distinguished between assessment of bilinguals and assessments for bilinguals. Now, I see assessment of bilinguals as being assessment of our bilingual students in all the content subjects, and they've got to demonstrate their knowledge. So he gave the example of a response in an exam. It's red and blue, y tiene una rava y una estrella. Excuse my accent. But how would examiners and other stakeholders react if they saw that response on an exam script? That's my question. If people started suggesting that we translate our question papers, not just into Welsh, but into, 160 languages, how many languages would we need to translate them into for equal access? If on an exam paper you saw the statement, read the passage in English, answer in your own language, again, in a multilingual context with 160 languages, how would we standardise the marking of those responses? I think what is very exciting for CIE as an international multilingual awarding body, I mean, there may be ways around the above question, but I think what's particularly exciting is assessments for bilinguals demonstrating their bilingual ability. I've seen in the literature mention of portfolio of bilingualism, acknowledging the bilingual continuum in which bilingual children operate. I don't think, again, this is necessary for an assessment body, but it might be something interesting for schools to think about. I also came across in the study that Stuart mentioned that we commissioned from Garcia's PhD students. They talked about a school in New York where they had a native language project. And this is for high school graduation. They had to produce a product. It could be visual, spoken, written, in their first language. And then they had to do a metalinguistic reflection of it in English and present it. And apparently there was a committee that had to listen to it, and they had to be, it was quite demanding. They were questioned on their L1 product. And all students had to do this in order to graduate. I found that quite interesting. But which part of the curriculum would this be in? Would it be in your language curriculum? Obviously, in New York, they created a new subject called home language. Or would this be in a content subject? My final slide is thoughts about benefits versus pragmatics. So to reap the benefits of translanguaging, and the benefits seem to be fuller understanding of subject matter and developing academic language skills in both languages. That seems to be a higher goal. Is translanguaging most effective as a classroom practice? That's my question. Is translanguaging assessment of bilinguals, enabling them to use their multiple linguistic repertoires to demonstrate their strength or their knowledge of history, math, science? Is it easier to implement equitably in dual language contexts, such as Wales and the United States, as opposed to multilingual contexts? You're probably thinking these look like rhetoric questions. Maybe this is what I believe, but you can challenge me. Is the responsibility on students to acquire sufficient language proficiency for monolingual assessments? So should we actually be saying to our candidates, you need to have this level of English if you want to enter for our examinations? Or should we be accommodating more than we already are? So is it sufficient to do what Stuart has mentioned, building language awareness into our monolingual assessments, having guidance for question paper writers? So we're striving for more equitable assessments, although I don't think you can ever achieve truly equitable assessments. Is there scope for innovative translanguaging assessments for bilinguals, e.g. in one subject, showing that bilingual is more than the sum of two monolinguals? I think a lot of the literature on translanguaging assessment in the United States is talking about, as Stuart mentioned, formative assessment, and that might be to do with the context of the United States, where am I right in thinking that there's no real high-stakes assessment apart from entrance university entrance exams. It's very much about the school developing its own graduation programme. So it might be that there's more focus on formative assessment. So it's a very different assessment context to here.
OK, I fear we must draw this to a close, as the time is really going on. But I would like to thank all our three speakers very much indeed. I found it really fascinating listening to you. Thank you.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.